When people in California talk about the big one, they're sharing their worries about something that hasn't happened yet. But they're remembering San Francisco in 1906. Between the earthquake and the fire that followed, there was almost total devastation of the city. Simon Winchester tells the story in a book called A Crack in the Edge of the World. The real problems came, he says, not from the quake, but from what happened next.
Two things happened. The fire chief was killed, Dennis Sullivan, died in his fire station, scalded to death by steam from a broken radiator. So the fire department was leaderless, but much more important than that, it was waterless, because all the water mains ruptured, and they were completely powerless to do anything about it. And so some very tough decisions had to be made about how to deal with this fire. And that, to my mind, is the most extraordinary thing about what happened, particularly when you compare the reaction of officialdom to what has recently happened after Katrina.
Well, speaking of officialdom, in San Francisco, there was, prior to the 1906 earthquake, pretty broad corruption in the city, which can't have done the city any good when the moment came when it needed most to have a leadership structure.
Well, you wouldn't have thought so. And yet, quite the reverse happened. I mean, just very briefly, what occurred. The earthquake happened at 5:12 a.m. on that Wednesday morning. One of the people bounced out of bed was a pretty appalling soldier called Frederick Funston, who had essentially been demoted after a pretty appalling career of violence and brutality in the Philippines, brought back to America and given the job as number two in the San Francisco garrison. The number one, General Greeley, was away at his daughter's wedding. Funston was bounced out of bed and realized instantly he needed to act. So he didn't care about the legality of what he was doing. He wrote a note to his adjutant down at the Presidio, sent someone on a horse galloping down there and said, summon all available soldiers, put them in full battle gear, march them through the ruins and the fires, and make them available to the mayor of the city. I mean, you can't these days just casually give federal troops into the custody of a city mayor, but Funston did. I mean, astonishingly fast reaction.
It is, and I guess the lesson isn't clear from this, although maybe the lesson is clear that we need people who will act without regard to
the legality.
The legality.
I think that's one of the problems, yeah. That this, we're not here to talk about Katrina, I know, but everyone was looking over their shoulders, is what I'm about to do legal? And it inhibits people from taking the kind of bold decisions that in the moment of a catastrophe seem to be necessary.
How did the city begin to recover? Because this is not something from which you can do anything with all the best of intentions and all the help in the world in any very immediate fashion.
Well, it was a classic example of the business of San Francisco is business. I mean, it was a city that its commercial baronies decided it's got to get back onto its feet pretty quickly. And in doing so, they passed up a chance for the city to become architecturally one of the gems of America, because there was this town planner called Daniel Burnham, who essentially had mapped out Washington, D.C. I mean, the mall and all those things in Washington are part of Burnham's mm-hmm. great scheme. Burnham was commissioned in 1904, 1905 to lay out a plan for San Francisco, which, after all, after its gold rush rambunctiousness, had really achieved the role of the imperial city. I mean, this was the city from where the Great White Fleet went westwards to dominate the Pacific, to have the colony in the Philippines, to trade with China, trade with Japan. America wanted a grand city on the West Coast. And so Burnham was called in to design one. And his design, which was, oddly enough, delivered to the mayor of San Francisco the day before the earthquake, was full of great boulevards and fountains and reflecting pools and statuary. It would have been a grand city. But they didn't. They immediately said, no, we can't be bothered with all this marble and all this folderol. We must rebuild the city on the old lot lines and just get back to work. And so they did. And within 2 years, you'd almost not know that the city had been hurt. And
it was. But was there at least any effort made by the people who rebuilt the city to make it stronger, make it better, make it different from the city that it had been before? Because you have to assume, having one of these events, there could be, one day, another.
Yes, and it has to be said that the California Earthquake Commission, under the leadership of this scientist called Andrew Lawson, did determine that he identified and indeed named the San Andreas Fault, and realized that that was the mischief maker that caused all the problems, and that it was likely to cause a problem again. But they did make the buildings stronger, and they did take precautions. They built flexibility into the fire water system, and they put big tanks under the road junctions. But the die was essentially cast because it coincided, the post-earthquake period, with the ascendancy of Los Angeles to the south. And there is one harsh reality, leaving aside the economic reasons for why Los Angeles became big, which was, of course, the film industry. The reason why Los Angeles became the capital of California, I mean the economic capital, obviously not the political capital, derives from a simple reality, that San Francisco lies exactly on top of the San Andreas Fault and therefore is theoretically prone for the rest of its existence to earthquakes, whereas Los Angeles has a swarm of lesser faults, but the San Andreas, the big mother, is 50 miles to the east, runs through, you know, Indian Wells and Palm Springs and places like that. It does not run through Los Angeles. And so Los Angeles is, in relative terms, a much, much safer place.
Is the world a safer place for this event having happened and been so clearly recorded?
No. Because of the cool indifference of the world to humankind, we now know why earthquakes occur. We know why earthquakes occur in California. The Pacific plate moving northwards at an inch and a half a year, scraping past the North America plate, friction not allowing it to for decades, and then suddenly it moves and that causes an earthquake. But knowing this does not allow us to predict, and that's the big problem. And when Art Agnos, one of the mayors of San Francisco, said rather testily to a geologist, "Look, you people are always going on about how dangerous our place is. Until you can give us 24 hours notice of an earthquake, just go away and be quiet." But the Earth has got this massive indifference and will keep on moving. And if we choose to place cities on top of the places where it does move, then we better woe betide.
But if in all your research you haven't discovered by now that people will want to live in a place as beautiful as San Francisco, even if there is the danger of an earthquake, but every morning they get to look at one of the most beautiful spots on Earth, well, then you haven't learned very much, have
well,
you?
Well, indeed, we certainly haven't. But there is a sort of broader reality, which I find very interesting, that in sort of old countries in the world, I mean, the European nations and Asian countries, our great cities are where time suggests that it's reasonable for them to be there. I mean, London, Paris, Moscow, Peking, Berlin. They're thousands of years old, and they're in seismically stable places, not afflicted by extremes of weather. And so it's reasonable that they should stay there. But by the same token, these same countries are littered with the ruins of cities that were built where they should not have been built, like Pompeii and Herculaneum and Petra and Heliopolis and Ayutthaya in Thailand. And we as tourists go and look at them and are awe-inspired and look at these ruins and amazed at the civilizations that built them, and we wonder idly why they're not major cities anymore. America, though, is a country without any ruins. It's got a few ghost towns in the West, but it has no ruined cities because America is young enough that it can put its cities down where it jolly well pleases, except for this cool indifference of the planet. And I wonder whether in 200 years' time, if you look at a map of the United States, whether there might not actually be some ruins that tourists go and visit. One of them, of course, obviously New Orleans, which when you think about it, it is sort of stupid to build a city 20 feet below sea level between a river and a lake in a part of the world that's afflicted by constant hurricanes. Similarly, Phoenix, Tucson, even Las Vegas. I mean, there is no water there. Sooner or later, that reality is going to catch up with people. And I cannot imagine, I mean, not many world cities are built in the middle of deserts. I can't imagine tourists going to see the ruins of Phoenix in future years and, you know, being awe-inspired by the relics
by
of
the
a Walmart or something. But then what of San Francisco? I mean, a very, very dangerous part of the world. Can it survive? I think it can if it learns a lesson from Japan. That's the one world country that has learned to accommodate to earthquakes.
Well, and Japan has had no choice if it wishes to continue to be a country because there are no seismically stable places on the Japanese islands.
Well, precisely, and yet it has managed to. It has managed to live to accommodate. It has competent people in every prefecture, every city. It's got emergency supplies. Its buildings are toughly built, and its people are trained, relentlessly trained, on what to do in the event that the earth starts shaking. In California, regrettably, they're still in denial. It's far too easy just to open another bottle of Sauvignon Blanc and pretend they're not there.
Simon Winchester's book is called A Crack in the Edge of the World.